spent days on these flying boats, so I expect her to attempt. Seems like days. That was just lunch. So, actually, the way this worked, in all honesty, Jack asked Ronnie Green if he'd give a talk to this committee, and I thought that was a brilliant idea. And Ronnie responded and said, I'd be happy to, and I think I should tag team it with Matt Spang and copy him. And so I'm here. But I do appreciate the opportunity. And so there's really one trait in particular, one project in particular that I'm going to focus some attention on, but I do want to call your attention to some other suites of traits, if you will, in particular, so that I can highlight some of the talks that are forthcoming yet at the conference. So helpfulness of beef, and what I mean by that, to separate it from the second one on the list, is not how healthy is the animal, but the healthfulness aspects of the end product. So things like fatty acid profile, nutrient content, and the loop in the T-scoop, who's in here, is going to cover that in general session talk tomorrow. Some work that she did when she was at Oklahoma State really started as a collaboration with the National Beef Cattle Evaluation Consortium. And then a pair of my students that are back there in the back, hoping that I don't point them out right now probably, but are going to cover some things that we've done at UNL in that regard in a technical committee session tomorrow afternoon. Disease susceptibility, Holly Nyberg's is on the program tomorrow, and Holly's part and really has leadership responsibilities, it's fair enough to say, for a very large grant focused on BRD. Reproduction, and admittedly, we have some EPDs for reproduction now. They could be dramatically improved. Okay? And the hope with genomics is that we could tackle some of those traits that are either expensive or difficult to measure. And so, which I know it was a slip, I don't mean to poke at you, Michael, but when I think of Jerry Taylor, I've never thought of somebody that's behind the scenes. And Jerry Taylor is involved in a lot of these projects. One of those is, of course, is a large grant focused on genomics reproduction and to tie in with sequencing efforts. And to piggyback on what the dairy industry has actually picked up on is, if we go into populations and begin to sequence, you can think of it as finding missing homozygotes, if you will. So simplistically, we see big A, big A, we say big A, little A, we see no little A animals. And so it begs the question why, and it suggests at least that those animals were unfit for some reason. And then feed intake and feed efficiency, which I'm going to spend a little bit more time talking about because I'm actually involved in this one, and so are some others that I've already mentioned. A large project, as are most of these integrated grants. And integrated, by that I mean they have both a research and an outreach component. And this just shows some of the people involved in it. Jerry Taylor happens to lead this particular grant. So the project is up to 5 years and up to $5 million. I think that's the way USDA likes us to reference these things, up to, because it wasn't supposed to be necessarily guaranteed, but we've been very fortunate to receive a renewal annually. And the grant ends in 2016, so that shows you where we are in this particular project. So if you think of the large umbrella objective, it is to develop tools that can be utilized for selection within our respective beef breed organizations. And those tools would be genomically at least enhanced, if not initially genomically derived in totality, to develop a cross-breed genomic selection program. There are other projects or other objectives in this grant as well, and that goes to some of the things that Dan Scheidt talked about this morning relative to potential differences in growing animals versus females and forage concentrate kinds of diets. And then you'll listen to Harvey Friedley tomorrow to discuss about some work that he's done looking at the relationship between different metrics of feed efficiency and methane output, which some of you may not think about as a critical topic, but I don't know if Dr. Barry from Ireland is still in the room or not, but certainly you move outside of the U.S., and actually that's a very critical topic. So talk about some of that work there. And then a neat thing about it, and Holly, I'm going to be pointing at you, and maybe at some point, if you want, just come up and take my place, that'd be fine. But Holly's running part of the mirror relative to repository of samples for this project as well. So a bit dated, admittedly, and you can look through all this if you want, but the point is this project includes multiple breeds and a large number of animals. And so if you think about high-hanging fruit, why was it high? Because it was hard or expensive to collect. And so as these grants began, really an objective was, we've got to collect a lot of phenotypes, we've got to genotype those animals. And a very large undertaking. And although $5 million sounds like a lot of money, folks, you start collecting a lot of phenotypes and genotyping a lot, and pay the people that do that, $5 million goes away fairly quickly. And so the nice thing about this is we have been able to leverage existing data that's out there in the industry. So I want to get to some results because that's always more fun to talk about. And so here's four different populations of animals. Hereford cattle, they were actually fed in Nebraska at Douglas Olsen's, okay, in a GrowSafe system there. And if you look at, when I look at data sets, it's always nice to take the number of animals and kind of divide it by the number of contemporary groups and really see what the information content is coming in. And if you look at this Hereford set, that's pretty nice when you look at the average number of animals in the contemporary group. F1 squared composites fed at U.S. Mark, and here I have what they were genotyped with, the 770 or the 50K, and about 1,160 animals there. Some legacy Simmental data fed at the University of Illinois, and Dr. Larry Berger, the department chair of animal science, my boss, would have been a part of this. And putting together that data at Illinois, and then legacy Angus cattle fed at either Circle A or Angus cattle fed at the University of Missouri. So you can think about it as kind of four different breed groups, if you will. So some results to show you. Here what I have is the additive genetic variance, the residual variance, and the heritability. So the heritability in this case is really the portion of phenotypic variation described by the markers, right? And we call that really the genomic heritability. And the point is, and you know, for those of you representing one breed or another in the room, don't start screening down this and saying, aha, gun matter intake is more heritable in Hereford cattle than it is in Angus cattle. That's not the take-home message at all. I violated all kinds of quantitative rules here by not putting any kind of metrics of error on that. But the point is that we are recovering, if you look at the literature, a very large proportion of the additive genetic variation that exists for these traits, because these genomic variabilities really align with what we expect from phenotypic information alone from the literature. So we're doing a very good job in these training populations. And you can look across for the traits of dry matter intake, metabolic and end weight, average daily gain, and of course residual feeding. If you do make some comparisons though, you could make the observation that perhaps we're not explaining as much of the phenotypic variation in some of these composite populations as we are in purebred populations. And if you'll remember, these cattle went through a GrowSafe system, and a lot of these cattle went through a different kind of intake system, went through Kalen Gates. And so the fact that we see larger residual variance here, as we do here, could be a reflection, perhaps, by some added noise that was introduced into the data because of differences in feed intake collection systems. This is hard to see, and it's always tempting in GWAS studies to show Manhattan plots. That's what these are. We go along across the genome, starting at chromosome 1 to the end. And the SNPs that are the highest are the ones that explain the most phenotypic or genetic variation. And what we actually do with this is we show it in presentations to make a point, okay? Because what we're interested in is the effects. And Manhattan, of course, because it's meant to look like the skyline of Manhattan, New York, right? The peaks, skyscrapers, not Manhattan, Kansas, right there, because that's zero signal across the entire genome. I'm a K-State grad, a Kansas native. What what I want to point out from this, though, is if we focus on dry matter intake here, you look at this dot, this is a SNP that's explaining roughly 10% of the additive genetic variation. And look, just relatively speaking, where that's located. And then compare it to the large effect SNP for Hereford dry matter intake, explaining about 4.5% of the genetic variation. And those aren't the same, are they? They're really not close to the same. And so the neat thing about that, and we know quite well, breeders in this room know that this information is not easily transferable across populations, easily transferable across breeds. Here's one, right? Here's one. We have different variants explaining different proportions of variation as we go across populations. Just to quickly summarize that part of it, additive genetic variance seems to be similar between Angus and Hereford. Lower heritability in Angus as compared to Hereford might be reflective of the feeding systems that were used to collect that. And those large effect quantitative trait loci and QTL do differ between breeds. Now, I mentioned that this is an integrated grant, which means there's outreach, and outreach, in my mind, is not just giving talks. Giving talks increases awareness. That's extension building. Increase awareness with that. But to truly be successful in outreach, it means you've got to get something to adoption. And it's my belief that visualization aids in technology adoption. We've been talking, we globally, about EPDs for decades. I'm going to show you some survey results that suggest that either we haven't been talking to the right people, we haven't been talking enough, and we need to do something more than talk. Okay? And so with that in mind, in 2009, we actually started a project called the Weight Trait Project. It included breeders from the Northern Plains that represent the 7 largest beef breed associations in the U.S. to test drive genomics, right? And so when this granting opportunity came along and called for an outreach program, we said, we've got a collective group of breeders, right, that savvy genomics. Let's roll them into this project. And that's exactly what we've done. And so again, just a reminder of what the Weight Trait Project is really designed to do. Call it Weight Trait because those are the traits we started with and matriculated to things like feed intake and feed efficiency now. And so these are the breeds represented. And sometimes, for whatever reason, one of those doesn't show up. And I always know quickly who it is because some of the audience from that breed says, hey, we're involved in that. We're not up there. But I think we've got them. And these breeders, what they've done is they've supplied semen from herd bulls that we've used to inseminate cows, either at U.S. Mark or a large commercial ranch in western Nebraska, taken the corresponding offspring, put them through feed intake systems, genotyped them with the 50K, we genotyped those sires with the 770, and we'll actually be able to evaluate, for demonstration purposes, the efficacy of the research results that come out of the project. The other benefit of this, actually, is we get carcass data on all those calves, send that carcass data along with the feed intake data to the breed associations, and it sounds like a little thing, but breeders really love the added carcass data coming in on the bulls to breed associations. The other part of the outreach program is a large national survey. Bob Weber was really in charge of that, and he's going to show these results at the World Congress in Vancouver coming up in August. I've sent out 7,500 surveys with 55 questions, and I'm told, I don't deal with a lot of survey data, but this response rate was actually fairly good. And Bob, when he ran through this analysis, focused on the roughly 60% of the respondents that were actually from the commercial cow-calf sector. And the rest of what I'm going to show you indicates their knowledge of genomics, of genetic selection, of feed efficiency in general. And roughly a third of these respondents, and so if you responded to this and you picked the wrong answers, you do not have to identify yourself in this meeting, okay? You can laugh with the rest of us. Roughly a third of them chose the correct definition for feed gain. Two-thirds of the commercial cow-calf respondents did not choose the correct definition for feed gain. So if we talk about implementing genetic selection for feed efficiency, I think we've kind of got to define some of those things first. About 16% had heard of the term residual feed intake. 14% were familiar with residual average daily gain. This is interesting. In terms of how they would improve feed efficiency, the majority said they would select for improved rate of gain. I wish Galen Erickson was in here right now. Less than that, 40% said improved diet formulation, and then you can see the proportion that thought feed additives or growth promoters. And about half of the commercial cow-calf respondents were uncertain of the consequences of selection for increased performance or average daily gain on the calorie. So, again, as we talk about emerging technology, Jack, it seems like we have a bit of an education and technology lag that's represented in our industry. And it's not this group, right? This group comes to BIF, so it's not you. It's your cohorts that don't come. So are they willing to pay? Producers were asked how much more they'd be willing to pay for a bull if a reliable method of evaluation were available for genetic comparative feed efficiency. 23% of producers said they wouldn't pay any more for that bull. 13% said they'd increase it by about $500, about 12% said $200 to $300, and 10% would increase their bid between $100 and $200 a bull. So Allison, I'm not saying that 23% was right. I'm just saying 23% of those people said that, which suggests for whatever reason there's some failure in feedback mechanism to them relative to this report. The knowledge of genomics. Roughly two-thirds said that they didn't know what class of traits would benefit the most from marker-assisted selection. And 13% kind of got it right, thought traits that were difficult or expensive to measure. Two-thirds didn't identify what the primary benefit of adding molecular breeding value data to EPDs was, which of course is increased accuracy of those EPDs, particularly on young sire. So this illustrates a pretty big problem in my mind, Michael. As we try to get the seed stock industry to genotype, and not just genotype the bulls they think they're going to sell to Aaron, all right, the bull stud, but genotype them all. If this is representative and two-thirds of their bull buyers say, I don't see value in it, then it's a challenge. It's a real challenge. I'll go over this pretty quickly. This just shows in that survey what the traits or suite of traits that were the most important to these people were over the last 5 years. And those people involved in selling bulls in here, I don't think that this is a shocker at all. Having ease of growth weight, reproduction of growth, those kinds of things. So, I'll be honest with you. I cobbled together about 20 slides so I could get to two where I wanted to get on soapbox. I think these grants are a platform, okay, from which the industry can leap from. If there is at all a thought that we're going to get through these grants, be it BRD, be it feed efficiency, and all of a sudden we turn over genomic prediction equations to the industry, and the industry doesn't have to do anything from that point forward, you are completely wrong. Okay? We're simply giving you, we're changing the intercept, giving you a place to start from. You are still going to have to collect these phenotypes. You are still going to have to genotype more animals, and you're still going to have to refine the genomic predictions. That's the way it's going to have to work. And not just for novel traits. Okay? If there is the pervasive thought at all that in an era of genomics we can stop collecting phenotypes, then what you're essentially saying is, I am fine with the accuracy of an EPD that has pedigree average plus molecular information, and I don't care if the accuracy ever increases past that. Essentially, that's what you're saying. And I don't think that's what any of you mean. If we want accuracy to continue to increase, we need progeny information, phenotypes, flowing into our national cattle evaluation. Not only does that increase the accuracy of sires, it also provides more information from which we can retrain in the future. So phenotypes are as critical as they have ever been. I would also make the argument that for novel traits, who we collect phenotypes on is important. So there was a time, Daniel, before LD chips, and genotypes were fairly expensive. We thought with limited financial resources, we needed to be strategic in who we genotyped, particularly with imputation in mind. We could spread that information throughout the pedigree if we strategically picked animals in the pedigree. Now, if phenotypes are really the limiting factor in terms of expense, and the objective is to develop a genomic prediction equation based on those phenotypes we collect and be able to utilize that across the rest of the population, then I would argue now who we phenotype is important. If I go out and phenotype just one sire family, and I say, now, Jack, you can use that information for all the rest of Hereford breed, it's not going to work very well. So I think we've flipped that around. I'd also make the large argument, and I started off with those novel traits at the beginning, and the list of traits now is just going to continue to grow. And if you thought sire summaries were cumbersome to read through before, it will get worse. Right? So selection based on economics, I would argue, economic index values, which are not new by any stretch of the imagination, can alleviate the cumbersome nature of multiple trait selection. At the same time, I think, can be more intuitive to bull buyers when you can compare sires or potential sires based on differences in revenue and hopefully differences in crop. Obviously, the difference between those two is, if we think about feed intake, dry matter intake is the input side of the equation for feeding at for the fed cattle sector. And so I think in the short term, at least, dry matter intake can be a nice critical input component into some of the already existing terminal revenue-based economic index factors. I think that's a very simple place to start in terms of utilization of this information. Now, with that in mind, if you go to this website, beefefficiency.org, and if you can't find it the first time, you probably misspelled efficiency. It happens to me sometimes. Never been good with letters. Right? If you go on there, there's actually a calculator, which is essentially an Excel-based tool that you can actually put in feed intake data, weight data. If you ran animals through a Kalen Gator GrowSafe system, you have that data. It calculates residual feed intake, residual average daily gain, and also calculates an economic index value for you that takes into account dry matter intake, metabolic mid weight, and gain. And that index was just not pulled out of thin air. It's actually from a published paper that came out of a joint graduate program actually between UNL and USMARC, a paper by Rolf and others in 2011. And so that's at least a way to illustrate to people that we can use indexes, and the fact is, if you select, Dave, based on residual feed intake, residual average daily gain, or an economic index contemplating those traits I just mentioned, it's not going to return the same bulls every time. Bulls are going to rank differently based on those three things, right? So I think that's an important exercise for people to understand. Now with that, Jack, I don't have an earthly clue as to how long I took, but I know that I'm done.